It is Monday, August the 14th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, white supremacist rally turns violent in a U.S. city, surviving the tense rhetoric between the U.S. and North Korea.
It's quite scary when a rogue nation can actually have the capability to put nuclear weapons onto U.S. soil. That's scary, but I think at the other end of the table, we've gone through this before. The Chinese have done this. The Soviets have done this. Other powers have done this. We will get through this.
U.S. Vice President in Latin America, but what's trending on social media all ahead? Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The U.S. Justice Department has opened a civil rights investigation into the deadly car ramming during a counter-protest against a white nationalist demonstration in the U.S. city of Charlottesville, Virginia, near the campus of the University of Virginia. One person died there when the car crashed into demonstrators, and two troopers died a bit later when a state helicopter, a police helicopter, crashed nearby. That chopper was keeping an eye on the rally below. Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe declared a state of emergency.
And I have a message to all the white supremacists and the Nazis who came into Charlottesville today. Our message is plain and simple. Go home. You are not wanted in this great commonwealth.
President Trump also spoke about the violence.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides.
That Saturday rally drew thousands of people who were upset about the planned removal of a statue commemorating the memory of a Confederate Civil War general. Kyle Condick is Director of Communications for the University of Virginia Center for Politics. VOA's Victor Beatty asked him if the legacy of the U.S. Civil War that was fought in the 1860s largely over states' rights and whether slavery was a viable states' right is currently being used for political gain.
You know, I think it is important to remember that sort of the news peg, if you will, for the events that happened in Charlottesville was this ongoing push by some, particularly on the left, to remove Confederate statues and to rename places named for Confederate generals. And, you know, the former Lee Park in Charlottesville is a great example. And that's something, you know, that's an ongoing thing in Charlottesville and in other places, too. And that was sort of the stated reason for the march. I mean, these neo-Nazis are they're looking for, I think, any excuse to get more publicity for themselves and their beliefs. But that was what this protest was pegged to. And there is, you know, there is a legitimate disagreement in communities across the country about what to do with these monuments. So that's, again, an important actual public policy part of this whole problem. And, you know, of course, the Charlottesville, you know, march became about much more than that, I think. But again, that was sort of the stated reason for it. And, you know, also, I mean, there's go through sort of, you know, how the Civil War was remembered in the United States after the war was over. And I think if you read the history of you know, what happened during Reconstruction and then Reconstruction ended, slavery ended, but what became this sort of promising hope for, you know, African Americans to really achieve full participation in American society, you know, there was this sort of time when it looked like that might happen, and then, you know, white supremacy reasserted itself in the South. And, you know, I mean, African Americans, I think, have had a hard time all over this country, just outside of the South. And, you know, I think it's fair to say that the country's made progress over many decades, but the promise of emancipation and I think the goals of Reconstruction, you know, I don't necessarily even know if they're met yet, because, you know, I think it's hard to say that a lot of whites have an easier time of it than African Americans do, based on being targeted maybe more so by law enforcement. And you can also look at, you know, housing policy in communities across the country where African American families were not welcome in certain communities, and, you know, that the African American families were not able to sort of buy houses and sort of use that as a way to build generational wealth. And then you also have this sort of backlash on among some whites that who feel like, you know, maybe that social change is sort of happening too fast, and that they're, you know, want to put the brakes on some of those things. And certainly the neo-Nazis in Charlottesville are a very extreme example of that.
Does the removal of the stars and bars from flags or the removal of monuments, renaming of schools, does that really advance the civil rights cause?
I think it does, personally. I mean, I think that ultimately the Confederate flag is a symbol of a white supremacist state. And I think that the goal is to have a society where you know, people regardless of their racial backgrounds have, you know, equal opportunity. And if communities are celebrating Confederate history and Confederate symbolism, I think that may be a sign that some of those communities aren't as welcoming as maybe they could be. So I do think that those things are important. Symbolism does matter.
Kyle, given the tragedy of the weekend's events, a young woman was killed, of course, and two police officers died in the line of duty. Can there be a rational debate about how to deal with the nation's past?
I don't think there can be a rational debate with neo-Nazis. I mean, the people who are marching in Charlottesville are, I think, beyond saving. But that I hope, represents only a very small segment of society. And clearly this nation is divided on all sorts of things. And I think, you know, how we remember the Civil War and how we remember the Confederacy is something that, reasonable people have disagreements with. And it's just another thing that ends up being a very divisive subject.
That's Kyle Kondik. He's Director of Communications at the University of Virginia, that is, Center for Politics. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. And what's being said now on social media regarding the violence at that white supremacist rally? My colleague Lori London is here. What do you have, Lori?
Well, Steve, in light of the violence at that white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, once again, we are seeing the power of social media, for good or bad. It is definitely changing our world. Now, the story spread to all platforms here in the United States and even around the world. People are watching. Former President Barack Obama took to Twitter on Saturday in a series of tweets, including several quotes from Nelson Mandela. And former Vice President Joe Biden also tweeted, along with many other prominent figures, including Hillary Clinton. President Trump also received quite a bit of criticism for his response, both in his statement and his tweets, including from quite a few Republicans who admonished Trump for not calling the protesters white supremacists. And interestingly, there's also been a bit of anti-racist vigilantism with the help of social media. Several Twitter users have been calling on others to identify people in the crowds marching at the vigil Friday night at the University of Virginia. Most notably, the account @YesYou'reRacist has been publishing photos on the social networking site and asking its more than 180,000 followers for help recognizing people in the crowds. Now, that request came with a tweet saying, quote, "If you recognize any of the Nazis marching in #Charlottesville, send me their names/profiles and I'll make them famous. #GoodNightAltRight. Now, the account is not just exposing these people, but it's also notifying their schools and employers of their participation in the rally. A number of people have been identified, including one young man whose picture went viral on social media. And that man, identified as Cole White, was linked to his job at a popular hot dog chain. Well, on Sunday afternoon, he was fired, and management at the Top Dog restaurant confirmed in an email that Cole White no longer works for the company. Many others were also identified and publicly shamed. And just to be clear, as far as we can tell from the research that we have done here, simply identifying someone by name from a public photo does not appear to be violating Twitter's privacy policies, but publishing private information like phone numbers or home address or social security numbers typically would be a violation of their policy. But also on social media, disturbing photos from cell phones have captured other less publicized incidents of violence surrounding the rally in Charlottesville, including a picture of white supremacists attending the rally beating a black man with poles in a nearby parking garage. That photo was posted on Twitter by a writer and photographer with Nation of Change, and it was apparently just one incident of many similar attacks on black people that were posted on social media.
And many thanks to you, Lori. VOA's Lori London. You can follow Lori on Twitter at Lori London. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And our program, International Edition, can be found at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. President Trump has offered fiery warnings for North Korea, saying the U.S. military is, in his words, locked and loaded. North Korean officials, in turn, have accused the U.S. leader of driving the Korean Peninsula to the brink of nuclear war. North Korea said on Thursday plans would be completed by mid-month to fire four intermediate-range missiles to land near the U.S. Pacific island of Guam. That is some 3,500 kilometers southeast of North Korea. Meantime, the top U.S. intelligence official, CIA Director Mike Pompeo, says he would not be surprised if North Korea tested another missile right away, given that it has had two tests in July amid rising tensions between Pyongyang and the Trump administration. VOA asked Harry Cassianis, Director of Defense Studies at the Center for International or National Interest, also a senior fellow at the China Policy Institute, for his read on all of this.
I think in terms of the missiles, I know Kim Jong-un had a statement, as you referred to, that they would be testing these medium-range missiles near Guam. I have to be honest, I don't think they're going to actually telegraph their move and tell us what they're going to do. I think it's very clear the North Koreans, in order to develop the nuclear capabilities they want to, they have to keep test-firing missiles. So I don't think you're going to actually see a test near Guam. I think what they're going to do is test another intercontinental ballistic missile. I think that's their most immediate need, because the capability they want more than anything else is to strike the U.S. homeland, to deter us from ever taking a military action against them. That is their biggest goal. So I think in the next days, I think their biggest thing that we're going to see is that a third intercontinental ballistic missile test.
And President Trump's National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, says, "We are not closer to war than we were a week ago," but he said, "We are closer to war than we were a decade ago." We asked Cassianis what McMaster might mean.
I think his comments are basically referring to the simple fact that tensions are rising. And I think what really struck everybody last week when the Washington Post report came out, essentially detailing that the North Koreans were much further along than anybody had thought, specifically being able to miniaturize nuclear weapons and put them on missiles. Essentially, what we're going through is another like Sputnik moment, I guess, if you will. 60 years ago, actually, this coming October, is when the Soviet Union put a long-range missile into the air and put a satellite above everybody's head. And that freaked the American people out. We're basically going through a mini version of the same thing. We've been caught off guard. You know, we've had different reports throughout the years of what North Korea's actual military capabilities are. And now we're being haunted by the fact that the North Koreans are much further ahead than what we thought. And it's quite scary when a rogue nation can actually have the capability to put nuclear weapons onto U.S. soil. That's scary. But I think at the other end of the table, we've gone through this before. The Chinese have done this. The Soviets have done this. Other powers have done this. We will get through this.
The U.S. will be placing new trade restrictions today on China, and we asked Cassianis if this is a backdoor way of pressuring Beijing on North Korea.
I think it is. And I think it's a very slow burn to make the Chinese know that we are going to hold them accountable. Because keep in mind, the way to ultimately put pressure on the North Koreans and to mitigate this challenge is we have to stop the resources that are going into North Korea that are fueling their nuclear and missile programs. And considering the fact that 90% of North Korea's trade goes through China, if the Chinese would actually enforce the sanctions, we can stop the amount of money that's going into North Korea so we don't wake up 6 months and a year from now with the North Koreans detonating a hydrogen bomb or having a three-stage ICBM that can guaranteed hit the United States. That's what we need to do.
Harry Kasanis is the Director of Defense Studies at the Center for National Interest and a senior fellow at the China Policy Institute. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence has begun a six-day trip to Colombia, Argentina, Chile, and Panama. During a news conference not long ago with Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos, Mr. Pence said, while Venezuela is on a path toward dictatorship, a peaceful solution to months of unrest and political turmoil is possible. And in light of recent comments by President Trump alluding to possible U.S. involvement in the political tensions in Venezuela, we asked Rice University Latin American scholar Mark Jones if the Venezuela will be a part of Mr. Pence's conversation all along with the Latin American leaders.
This is a trip that was previously scheduled, but while Venezuela will not be part of the public discussion in most instances, I'm certain it will be part of the private discussion he has, especially with Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos, because of the proximity of Venezuela to Colombia and the fact that of all the countries in Latin America, the country that would be most affected or is most affected by chaos in Venezuela is Colombia. But it will also be a topic of discussion with Argentine President Mauricio Macri, who is increasingly assuming a leadership position within Latin America, trying to help address the Venezuelan crisis. And this is particularly occurring given the leadership vacuum that exists in Brazil, which traditionally would occupy that role of the regional leader. But with President Temer confronting corruption accusations after having impeached President Rousseff for misuse of public office, Brazil is really in no position right now to play that leadership role. I suspect it will be less of a topic when Vice President Pence is in Chile, in part because the governing center-left coalition of Michelle Bachelet has some members who are still supportive of President Maduro, and therefore it's unlikely, and she'll be leaving office in any event early next year.
Jones said that President Trump's indication of the U.S. getting involved in Venezuela has only brought disdain from Latin American leaders and created sympathy for Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, who is seen by the opposition there as a power-grabbing dictator. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of astronomers led by the UK's University of Hertfordshire say they have found four Earth-like planets orbiting the closest sun-like star. Two of the four are located in the habitable or Goldilocks zone, an orbital region around its sun where it is not too hot nor too cold and where liquid water could exist on a planet's surface. The team says each of the planets, which have a mass of about 70% more than Earth, are circling Tau Ceti, a star located about 12 light-years away in the Cetus constellation. If the two planets initially identified as habitable could actually support life, the astronomers suggest Tau Ceti could make an ideal destination for interstellar colonization. The downside, however, is the star is surrounded by a huge debris disk, which could reduce the habitability of the planets. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Time now for our music department report, and today we're going to take it somewhat slow and easy.
Trying times is what the world is talking about. You got confusion all over the land. Mother against daughter, father against son, the whole thing is getting out of hand.
born Roberta Cleopatra Flack in 1939 in the U.S. state of North Carolina and known worldwide as an incomparable jazz, soul, and R&B singer. That's right, that's Roberta Flack.
Got the riots and the ghetto, and it's all around. A whole lot of things that's wrong is going down. I don't understand it. My point of view, I remember somebody said, do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Born into a musical family, Flack first hit the professional music scene with a part-time gig performing in Washington, D.C., while teaching junior high school students and piano lessons in the daytime. While a regular performer at Mr. Henry's nightclub near the U.S. Capitol, top-name artists such as Dionne Warwick, Ramsey Lewis, and others dropped by to hear her smooth and intoxicating voice.
People always talk about man's inhumanity to man, but what you trying to do to make this a better land? Just pick up your paper, turn on your TV, you see a lot of demonstration for equality.
In 1969, Atlantic Records released Flack's first album with Trying Times, one of the more popular cuts, along with The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face.
The first time ever I saw your face, I thought the sun rose in your eyes, and the moon and the stars were the gifts you. And the endless skies, my love, to the dark and the endless skies.
Her Atlantic Records albums didn't sell too well until actor-director Clint Eastwood asked to use Flack's The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face in his hit movie Play Misty For Me.
I felt the earth move in my hand. Trembling heart of a captive bird that was there at my
For her collaborations, Roberta Flack began singing duets with Donny Hathaway, scoring hits such as the Grammy-winning The Closer I Get to You.
The closer I get to you,
know I first encountered her 47 years ago, right here in Washington. Amazing to see what's happened. Hey, listen, everyone, thanks for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. So good to have you with us. Latest world news, it's straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a super Monday. Now a bit more from Roberta Flack, and we'll hear Donny Hathaway.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For much of its brief existence, South Sudan has been mired in a civil war, a conflict that has killed tens of thousands of people and forced some 4 million to flee their homes, creating Africa's worst refugee crisis since the 1994 Rwandan genocide. A 2015 peace agreement and a transitional government formed in early 2016 failed to end the violence. In late May of this year, President Salva Kiir declared a unilateral government ceasefire and promised a release of political prisoners. But no prisoners have been released, and despite the ceasefire, heavy fighting has been reported in parts of the country, according to the UN. This is particularly true of the opposition stronghold near the town of Pagak in Upper Nile State. On July 24th, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, an eight-country regional development organization in East Africa that has been trying to mediate the situation in South Sudan, announced that it will convene a forum to revitalize implementation of the 2015 peace agreement. In late July, Norway, the United Kingdom, and the United States, known as the Troika in the context of the South Sudan peace effort, as well as the European Union, issued a statement condemning the continued violence in South Sudan. The PAGAC offensive is a clear violation of the unilateral ceasefire declared by President Salva Kiir and calls into question the government's commitment to reach peace through the national dialogue. The statement welcomed the IGAD decision to revitalize the South Sudan peace process. The proliferation of violence, displacement, and food insecurity renders any discussion of elections in the foreseeable future as an unnecessary diversion from the primary goals of achieving peace and reconciliation, said the Troika statement. South Sudan's leaders, neighbors, and regional and international partners must first focus on achieving peace in order to create the conditions needed to hold credible elections. To achieve these urgent goals, we look forward to the prompt revitalization of an inclusive and credible peace process by IGAD. Such progress would be required in order for the Troika and EU to commit further resources to institutions designed to implement the agreement.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.